Good evening. I would like to welcome you all to this evening's much-anticipated lecture, which will be delivered by Professor Pino Arlacchi, a world-renowned scholar on organized crime with a particular focus on the mafia. Professor Arlacchi's publications, many of which have been translated into English, French and German, include La mafia imprenditrice, dalla Calabria al centro dell'inferno, Mafia contadini e latifondo nella Calabria tradizionale, and Perché non c'è la mafia in Sardegna. Professor Arlacchi has also written Addio Cosa Nostra and Gli uomini del disonore, two works inspired by a series of encounters with the pentiti Tommaso Buscetta and Antonino Calderone. His most recent publication is L'inganno e la paura, il mito del caos globale, in which Professor Arlacchi strives to dispel some of the myths surrounding terrorism. Advances made in research on the phenomenon of the mafia and its inner workings are deeply indebted to Professor Arlacchi's studies, which have provided over the years a constant source of inspiration not only to scholars but also to the authorities involved in the enactment of anti-mafia legislative bills. Among the many well-known figures who drew on Professor Arlacchi's works for a deeper understanding of the mafia was Judge Giovanni Falcone. In more ways than one, Professor Arlacchi is both a man of letters and a man of action. In the 2007 edition of his book, La mafia imprenditrice, Professor Arlacchi describes the way in which his book marked a turning point in his life when it first came out in 1983, since it provided him with an opportunity to work closely with Pio La Torre, Rocco Chinnici, Giovanni Falcone, and Paolo Borsellino. Over the past two decades, Professor Arlacchi has served as a member of the Italian Senate and of the Chamber of Deputies. And in the years 1997-2002, he was appointed Under Secretary General of the United Nations, charged with the task of fighting terrorism, organized crime, and illegal markets. Professor Arlacchi is currently a member of the European Parliament within the ranks of Italia dei Valori. Today, Professor Arlacchi will be delivering a lecture entitled The Great Deception. We have never been more secure, yet never more vulnerable. The lecture will be followed by a book signing. On behalf of the Faculty of Arts, the Dean Professor Dominic Fenech and I would like to thank you all for coming. And thank you, Professor Arlacchi and Mrs. Arlacchi, for accepting our invitation.
Grazie. Bene, grazie per essere qui questa sera, grazie all'Università di Malta, a Gloria, Preside Domenico e a tutti voi che avete avuto la pazienza di venire qui ad ascoltarmi. Questo filmato avete visto un po' una parte del lavoro che ho svolto negli ultimi anni. The CD you have just looked is a synthesis of a part of the work I did in the United Nations and part of my engagement in fighting big evils like organized crime, drug trafficking, drug traffickers, terrorism, and organized crime in Italy, the mafia, as you know. And I consider myself a very lucky person because I could do something that is not quite easy to do. In a period of my life, I was only thinking, studying organized crime, drugs, terrorism, corruption, all this difficult matter to understand from a scientific point of view. And in another period of my life, I was able, I got the privilege to apply in practical terms what were the conclusion of my scientific work, putting into practice the main results, the conclusion of my work. First, being a politician, but also being an advisor of the Italian government, or during the 5 years I spent in the United Nations, as a man responsible for the implementation of the world strategies against all these evils. So it is a big privilege, because it is impossible to do both things at the same time. So it is impossible to be a man of action, to act, and at the same time being able to think fully about what you are doing. Or if you think, you are not able at the same time to apply or to put into practice the results of your thinking. So this was a big privilege, so I got these periods which I was engaged into practical action, and then going back, reflecting on what I did, trying to improve, trying always to go ahead and to learn from the several mistakes you do when you act. And at a certain point I tried to do a general overview, a kind of balance, a kind of synthesis of a lifetime commitment into dealing with the issue of big violence. Because the common thread of my work was understanding violence. A small violence, like the violence of ordinary crime, bigger violence as the violence of organized crime, and then the biggest violence, the most expression of the supreme violence, which is wars, genocides, conflicts, civil wars between states, between groups, between different entities. And I realized that maybe there was a common thread. It was possible to have a common interpretation. Also, I tried to find long-term trends in this, in the violence, in the use of violence in the human relationship, because of some very, very interesting historical work that has been done, that is being done by first-class students that are trying to look at the trends of violence in a multi-secular perspective. So how was violence in the history of humanity since, let's say, 3, 4, 5, 10, and even more centuries. And I was astonished in finding that there is a trend. It is not true that the use of violence in human relationships is always constant, so that man is violent, has been always violent, you always used violence in a big way in the relationship with his senior. There is a trend, and the trend is not what many students of last century believed. You know, it's a commonplace to say that the Novecento, the 20th century, has been the most violent century in history, so that there was no progress in the use of violence. So man grew technologically, modern technology applied to war and to violence, allowed man to exterminate other men in an easier and larger way than in the past. So the 20th century, with the two wars, with fascism, communism, Nazism, as the most deadly century in the history of humankind. I went very in depth in my book about this issue, using the results of extremely interesting research that has been done by a group of historians that analyzed the tried to analyze and also to have a statistical evidence about violence in a multi-century perspective, multi-secular perspective. And what they did find was an astonishing clear trend of decrease of violence. They analyzed the most serious crime of all, homicide. And they calculated, looking at archive data, because as you know, homicides are the only crime that is carefully recorded in every possible situation, every community, every state since the 13th century onward does a record, a statistical record of the homicides. There are, from a certain century onward, also judicial record. There are formal prosecution of homicides. There are laws about homicides. And so the archive data about killings and homicides are quite reliable. And they did these multi-secular studies, starting with limited areas of Northern Europe, and then going into other countries of Europe, looking at the trends in homicides from, let's say, 14th century to today. And it is an astonishingly clear trend in diminution. The decrease of homicides is simply spectacular, and it occurs everywhere in Europe. First in Northern Europe, then in Southern Europe, first in cities, then in countryside, first in central areas and then in more remote areas, but the trend is uniform. You have a difference in terms of homicides between the Middle Age and today in most Europe, which is 50-1. I mean, it's not a big decrease, let's say 50% or 30%. Is the number of people who in an ordinary community in Europe was killed at the time of Dante was 50 times the number that occurred today. Rate of homicide was today is more or less 1.2 in modern Europe every 100,000 people. It was 50 times bigger in the Middle Age, and there is basically no research that contradicts this data. This research has been done in many parts of Italy, in many regions, and all the results concur in this direction. So, we have a multi-secular trend. Also, anthropologists did a lot of very interesting work about primitive societies, and there was a big discussion among them on what was the trend in stateless society and society that started to have an even embryonic state organization, and the result was the same. There was a huge decrease from primitive societies where the rate of casualties in wars and conflicts was such that even sometimes 50% of a community was destroyed into killing and into clashes, violent clashes between communities, and the state, the invention of the state, society that know the distinction between civil society and state, where the attempt to by the state to build a monopoly of violence provoked a big decrease of violence. And you know that the most important definition of the state by Max Weber, by sociologists, is the state as a monopolist of violence in a given territory. I did also other calculations and statistics about the number of people dead in several big crime and genocides, and the trend has been basically the same. There is a huge decrease. And after 1945, after the end of the Second World War, we have a kind of increase of peaceful relationship, not only between men at micro level, but also at a micro level, between states and big communities. We have, from 1945 to the end of the Cold War, to 1989, a decrease of international war that in some regions of the world, like Europe used to be the most violent continent on the planet. We, the Europeans, we fought each other for five centuries almost uninterruptedly, continuously, to the point that most political scientists define peace as just the period that, that occurs between two wars. We had the wars almost every 3 years in this continent. We have more than 400 big conflicts from the 15th century to the last century, and this marked a big difference between Europe, for instance, and Asia, that has no similar tradition. There was a very careful calculation of wars occurring in China and the surrounding countries, and we got a difference that is between 40 to 1 if we compare Europe and China in the last 5 or 6 centuries. What occurred in 1945? That Europe at a certain point became a peaceful continent. International wars start to decrease, and now they are basically a quite old memory. No one is thinking realistically and seriously that it is possible to foresee a war between two major or minor European countries. War is basically something that is looked as a concept completely foreign to the mentality of young people, and also from my generation onward, we don't know what is war. So Europe today is asserting itself in the world as a very peaceful continent, marking a huge difference with its past. What occurred after the end of the Cold War? Because you could say, okay, international wars decreased a lot. We have now very few examples of international war all around. But civil wars substituted international war. We have plenty of civil conflicts all around the world. And so, it's not a big deal. After all, you have a lot of people that are dying in internal conflicts, ethnic, regional, political, civil conflicts of whatsoever nature. And so where is the progress? Where is the deal? So I looked at all most important databases on conflicts. Uppsala, University of Uppsala database, which is one of the best, University of Maryland databases. There are university centers, 2 or 3 in the world, who take a very careful analysis and statistics of conflicts every year. And even if you analyze this data, you see the same trend. After 1989, there was a huge decrease of civil wars. According to different criteria of classification, we have a decrease that is between 30% and 60-70% in civil wars all around the world. So now you have basically a concentration of most civil conflicts in 2 areas of the world: Africa, where you have between 60% and 70% of the wars and in civil wars and conflicts, and South East Asia and Afghanistan. If you take out from the map this, you see a world that has never been so safe. genocides. Genocides, the decrease in genocides and attempted genocides in the last 30 years is around 90%. So now you have just one possible genocide in the world, which is Darfur. 30 years ago, you have more than 20 between actual genocides and attempted genocide. You have also a huge decrease in other forms of violence, and the people at a certain point would ask, but this is not what we read every day in newspaper. What you see every day, if you open any newspaper, is a world that is in a catastrophic situation, in which actual risk, lethal risk, violence, conflicts, war are occurring every day, every moment. Terrorism, for instance, is considered today the main threat, the threat number one to the stability and the safety of the world. But I can tell you that if you go and look at the data, you have exactly the opposite reality. If you go on the internet, you take State Department database on terrorism, or RAND Corporation database on terrorism, or ITERATE, the three main databases on terrorism, you see the same trend. Huge decrease. International Terrorism Act peaked around the middle of the 80s, 1986, 1987, with 650 terrorist attempts and all over the world, and then more or less regularly decreased and are still decreasing all over the world. Now every year you don't have more than 200, 250 terrorist attempts. Number of victims of terrorism is extremely small compared to any other act of violence or traumatic death. Every year in the world you have an average of between 200 and 300 people dead from terrorism, which is not the figure that can qualify for considering terrorism a real serious threat to the security of anybody. But at the same time, you look at the newspaper, you look at some government statement, and you see terrorism defined as the Third World War, as the vital enemy for Western civilization, and a lot of this kind of hype about terrorism. Many students of terrorism, not all, but I would say the majority of students of terrorism agree, including me, that if terrorism would be treated as it is, in terms of the threat that it really represents to the stability of the world and to the individual safety, an act of terrorism would be treated in the media as a car accident, that with the same status of media, according to its real ability to threat the safety of individual and the collective security, that would be the most radical blow against terrorism. Because 90% of the terrorist act is theater, media, hype, and the fact that terror in itself, terrorism started being considered as such because of terror, because of the ability to inspire fear into people, possibly into government, and transforming what are in reality very small damages and no almost ability to destabilize anything into a big threat, into a vital threat to the safety and the stability of the world. Many students of terrorism showed, analyzing each act of terrorism that historically occurred, for instance, in Europe, at the end of the last century, and even today, and their consequences on the political stability of countries, on the, let's say, political life of countries, and no one has been able to detect any significant effect into international politics or even into national politics. There was no example of a single country in which a terrorist act succeeded to change the so-called course of history. End of last century, beginning of 2 centuries ago, at the beginning of the 20th century, anarchists killed almost all possible statesmen in Europe. They killed the Prime Minister of France, Prime Minister of Spain, they killed the Russian Tsar, they killed the Archduke of West Austria, they killed the King of Italy, they killed almost everybody who was available to be killed, just in 10-15 years. But if you read the book of history, you will find just footnote on it. Why? Because consequences were so small that there was no significant, no serious historian can say that the history of Europe or European country is being changed by a terrorist act. Even the famous Sarajevo killing that started the First World War is not considered as a triggering anything of significance, because the war would occur anyway. The number of tensions in the international community in that period was such that there was no need to kill the king to start the war. So, why terrorism is so highly considered by the media and by the community? Why this construction of fear that you see every day in newspaper? The same occurs on crime. We have, since 20 years, a very clear trend that shows that crime, all kind of crime, or violent crime, not there are forms of crime are increasing, but violent crime, what scare normally ordinary people, is decreasing in Europe and in the United States in a very substantial way. In Europe, if you take violent crime, homicides, and so on, you have a decrease in the last 20 years around between 25, 30, until 50 or 60%. In a country like Italy, quite close to here, the decrease in homicides in the last 20 years is simply astonishing. At the beginning of the 90s, we got in Italy almost 2,000 homicides a year. There was a moment in which a region like Sicily at the beginning of the 90s, you got almost 500 homicides, just in one region, in one area. Today, you have not more than 650 homicides every year in Italy. So the decrease was substantial, and similar data can be found in other European countries. The United States, you know, is a big crime decline. That is a similar proportions, maybe a bit more, and is uniform all over the United States and Canada. So, I understand that this can be, all this data can be very strange to many of you. And I wrote this book, calling it Inganno la paura, Deception and Fear, trying to explain this huge gap between the perception of security that we have conveyed to us by the media, by some government, and the reality. The reality shows a huge improvement that is occurring and is constantly going on. Peace is advancing, and at the same time, we are more and more fearful. We fear more and more, and we believe to live in an impossible world, in a world that is on the edge of the catastrophe almost every day. My explanation is that we have two big industries who are making profits of this huge gap. One is the industry of security, the industry who sell instrumental security. First of all, arms. Armament industry that in the United States now has a turnover of more than $600 billion every year. The United States today alone account for 50% of the world expansions in armaments. And the second big industry is the media industry, international media industry, because the sensationalization of facts, the amplification of the fear of the people, increase audience, increase the copies of newspapers, increase the interest of the people, because the more a person is scared, the more he wants to know about what's happening, about the source of this scare. This huge, the increase of the power of these two industries is one of the reasons, one of the most solid and rational cause I can detect about the increase of this collective sense of fear. Then you have also other sources, experts who are linked to the armament industry or to governments who want to increase the sense of fear. In Europe, fortunately, cannot be included into this area, because Europe is having a strategy that is quite different from this paradigm. But you have experts in security who build fear all the time. When I go to international conferences with my colleagues, I'm the only one who has a different approach between them. But the reason is very simple. I'm not linked to any business. I have no contract with any private or public firm who work on it, on the peer and of providing, offering security services to public and private entities. So I am free to analyze risk, to see what is worrisome or not. I am, let's say, in a position that the position that should be the position of the university, the position of the free scientific world, which is not to encourage collective paranoia, but is our task working in the university is to look at the reality, to look at things as they are, trying to then to contribute to the public discourse, trying to improve and also to find ways to fight big evils. I'm not saying with that we should, I'm not encouraging a candid version of the modern world. I'm fighting all these evils since all my life, but I fight these evils because I believe that we can overcome them, that we are much stronger than them. If we make this evil, these enemies, much bigger than they are, if we exaggerate their size, we obtain exactly the opposite effect. We are vehicle of discouragement, we are vehicle of paranoidal view, and basically we lose the faith in the possibility of building a more decent world. Since I believe that peace is much stronger than war, since I believe that goodwill of people and the ability and that we are able to fight this evil effectively, that we can really get rid of some historical evil, I believe that we, for instance, we could get rid of war. I believe that we can start to think about formal prohibition of war. Time has come to do it. We built the United Nations in 1945 with the idea that we would never see again the biggest of evil, this war, in the planet, and that we could build a mechanism to prevent and forbid armed attack between states. I always believed that we could get rid of the mafia, when people in my country believed that I was crazy, that the mafia was there since centuries and that there was no way to get rid of it, that the mafia was a part of the DNA of Sicily and of Italy, and so it was silly or crazy to fight the mafia. And there was also a very long intellectual tradition going back to great writers and even philosophers and political scientists of Sicilian origin that taught about the impossibility to change. No, the leopard, the theory of the circulation of elite by Gaetano Mosca was a Sicilian senator that built his theory about the circulation of elite, observing mafia groups in Palermo. All this conveyed a skeptical view of evils, of the mafia evils, that I started to challenge 20 years ago, showing that the mafia is an historical phenomenon, like war, like violence, that can, at the beginning, and can be also reduced to a bare minimum or eliminated. So I started to work and to fight the mafia, not just because I thought it was just to do it, but because I thought it was possible to do it. And I did it all my life. When I took my office in the United Nations, I launched the strategy to eliminate illegal crops, opium cultivation, and coca cultivation in the world within 10 years. It was 1998. The strategy was approved by the General Assembly of the United Nations in that year, and after 10 years, I did not succeed to go to 100% of what I had in mind, because we have still drug cultivation in Afghanistan, as you have seen in the video. But at the same time, the number of countries who produce narcotics has been severely reduced. We have basically now two countries that produce narcotics. Afghanistan for opium, Afghanistan produces 95% of the world opium supply, and Colombia for coca and cocaine. Was not so 12 years ago, when you got more than 20 countries producing it. So now the final battle is in two countries instead of 20. And this year, that strategy has been examined after 10 years, and the countries concluded that even if the goal has not been reached 100%, there has been such a progress that the strategy deserves to be renewed and confirmed for another 10 years. So it's a fight that does not end, but I believe that is a fight that is worth to be done. And the original title of my book was The Strength of Peace. Because I believe that the forces that move peace, forces that move the goodwill of the people, are much stronger than the opposite one. So we are not on the wrong side of history. I believe that we are on the right side. That is only a question of believing it, concentrating resources, having rational analysis that help us to go ahead, and then we can think today of challenges that were unthinkable just a few decades ago. This is not true only in the area of violence, crime, drugs, terrorism, and so on. It is true on even bigger challenges, because drugs, crime, terrorism are big issues, but there are much, 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 much bigger issues. For instance, poverty. Now we are able to think about elimination of poverty. The assembly of the head of states in New York, at the General Assembly in the year 2000, established a strategy to halve poverty into 10 years, and now we, in 4 years, we will have the first balance of the, and results are mixed, but this strategy, the idea that poverty is not forever, but they can be eradicated or severely reduced, is something that is considered possible. Until 40 years ago, no one thought that this was possible. Only socialism or communism was the idea that fostered this goal. Now the development of productivity is such that socialism is superfluous. We could get rid of poverty with a so tiny sacrifice of the income of the rich countries that no one would even realize that is done. We are discussing now the Tobin tax. Tobin tax is a 0.0001% taxation of a financial transaction worldwide. With the Tobin tax, we could have such a substantial amount of resources that we could reduce poverty in the world in just 4 or 5 years. Reduce substantially, it means eliminating absolute poverty and having a substantial reduction also of relative poverty. All this was absolutely unthinkable, and we are talking about the biggest problem of humanity since his birth. So my experience in the United Nations made me more optimistic, because I realized from that point of view, that point of observation, that there is no problem that man created that cannot be solved by men themselves. Thank you very much.
Ieri al Parlamento europeo, il gruppo socialdemocratico, e credo che la mozione è stata mossa dall'onorevole Di Pietro, sulla mancanza di libertà di stampa in Italia. Crede che questa mozione portata avanti da Di Pietro sia solo paranoia giornalistica? Seconda domanda. E la scena politica in Italia al momento parla di lodo Alfano e quello che è successo ieri quando il Presidente del Consiglio ha attaccato la magistratura, la Corte Costituzionale e pure il Presidente della Repubblica. Ci può dare delle chiarificazioni su questa situazione in Italia?
Dunque, no, naturalmente non credo sia paranoia giornalistica, visto che ero lì e ho votato quella mozione, e visto che faccio parte del gruppo d'Italia dei Valori, quindi è evidente che condivido l'analisi circa i problemi seri che la democrazia in Italia ha in questo momento a causa delle limitazioni di fatto della libertà di stampa. Tanto è vero che c'è stata poi una votazione su questa prima mozione, una votazione procedurale, ma che ha mostrato già un netto, la votazione finale ci sarà a Strasburgo tra 15 giorni, ma che ha mostrato un netto orientamento favorevole del Parlamento europeo. But this is an issue that is not only Italian. In Strasbourg, in 15 days, we will discuss the issue of limitations to the freedom of press in Europe. Because Berlusconi is not the only issue. In Italy, it has a special gravity, is a more serious problem than in any other European country. But at the same time, we have other media concentration, for instance, Murdoch concentration and others, Springer in Germany and so on, that pose a similar potential or actual threat to the freedom of press. Because, you know, the problem is the structure of the media. It's not the fact that no one is forbidding a journalist to write what you think. You can have a limitation of democracy in a country that is formally perfectly democratic, in which everybody can say or write whatever he wants. But if you speak with journalists, they will tell you that the so-called self-censorship is the problem. If you know that the owner of your newspaper is somebody who has an interest in a certain area, you naturally start to exercise a self-censorship. You don't simply write about this subject, so don't write something that can hurt the owner of your newspaper or of your TV or of your media. So the problem is the structure of the media that can in itself be a threat to democracy. Italy is the extreme case because you have one person who owns all private TV, at the same time is the prime minister of the country, looking actively into the public media, the RAI, intervening, attacking journalists who are not that he doesn't like, almost every day, since years. So if this is not the limitation of the freedom of press, what it is, the limitation of the press? So our European colleagues from different parties, this is not a political issue, simply. This is an issue of the basis of democracy that goes much beyond left and right. Any person who is committed to democracy should be worried about this situation. And this is the reason I believe we will have a quite strong support and a majority in the European Parliament for a position, for a resolution that can be transformed into directive by the European Commission on the freedom of press and on the specific issue of concentration. The attack by Berlusconi to the President of the Republic and to the Constitutional Court and to the judiciary and so on is something that we are seeing in our country since quite a long time. And I believe that this is another serious danger to democracy. It will not be easy to obtain a result because, as you are seeing, Constitutional Court does not seem to be particularly intimidated by this attack. The judiciary is doing his work anyway, but it is a unique fact in the Western world at this moment. We are very worried about the future of Italian democracy. The defense of Berlusconi is this: I am elected by the people, and because of that, I have the right to govern without limitations and without impediments by anybody. Our counter argument is he is not elected by the people. Italy is a parliamentary republic. Prime Minister is nominated by the President of the Republic because he was able to collect a parliamentary majority and is not elected by the people at all. Second, he is the head of a coalition. When he says he mixed polls with the electoral results, he says I have 60-70% of the people who support me. This is pure fantasy. This is polls, pollsters, that I deeply dislike. As a sociologist, I can show you technically how dishonest are most of these polls. And polls have no relevance into a constitutional process. You cannot say that you can rule Italy because you did a poll and the people told you that you can do so. Democracy is popular consensus, but democracy is also rule of law, division of power, and he simply seems to ignore completely this fact. And this is an idea of democracy, of a populist democracy, which is the beginning of authoritarianism. Authoritarianism starts with this appeal to the people, people who believe that they have a special mandate from the people, according to which they can violate the rule of law, violate constitutional limitations, and so on. Democracy is a very complex construction. So this is a shortcut that works very well in a not very well educated society, in which you can go straight to the people, like him, with all his power with the media. And this is also a further damage to democracy. Instead of educate people to the concept of democracy, you do a deep, not education, diseducation of the country. The country at this point has to react, and we hope that constitutional limitations will at the end operate in a way that we can protect ourselves for the future from this risk. There are also, I mean, it's a long story, other responsibilities. I was in the parliament beginning of the 90s, and when the current opposition was in the government, it also a lot of mistakes. I was at that time in the government, and we did a big mistake. We did not do a law on the conflict of interest, because we thought it was superfluous, because we thought that Berlusconi was a passing phenomenon, and we did not do this law, which is a law operating in most advanced democracy, that impedes exactly the problem that we have now, that impedes people who own media to go into politics, that make a law that forbids this mixture of media ownership and political militancy. Oh, me and another five senators tried to do a bill in this direction for a conflict of interest, and we lost. We have been derided by our colleagues, who told us that we are fixated with Berlusconi. I'm speaking about 1994. They told us, you are fixated with Berlusconi, stop thinking all the time about Berlusconi. He is dead, he is not a serious stuff. This bill does not deserve to be carried out. And our bill was put aside. Now we have the paradox that the opposition is accused to not have done this law on the conflict of interest. Anyway, I believe it is a very serious, extremely serious issue, but I am also positive on the future of Italian democracy. I believe that at the end, the rule of law and the democratic feeling of the country will prevail.
In your calculations about this tax, did you factor in the human tendency, human inclination towards corruption? If we take Africa, where we know poverty is very widespread and very serious, we know that a lot of African countries are very rich indeed, resource-wise. But most of their ills are due to corruption, mismanagement, etc. I mean, you mentioned 1994 in connection with Berlusconi. I would like to mention 1994 in connection with Rwanda. You know what happened in Rwanda in 1994. And my question is, how can you be so optimistic, thinking in economic terms, by mentioning this tax, that it will eventually resolve a lot of the problems surrounding with the world poverty? Whereas all the time we are seeing that human corruption and human malaise seems to underline and undermine so many human efforts. Thank you.
Very, very good question. I basically agree with you. I don't believe that just increasing investment of resources into fighting poverty or fighting other evils can be the solution. It's not enough, public tax. It's just the beginning of something. If somebody give us the resources to do it, give us the hardware, then the software is another big issue. For Africa, true. You can even double, triple the resources that you send to Africa and see no result. Or even, paradoxically, in some case, do more harm than good. Why? Because there are perverse mechanisms related to the delivery of aid that can play a very negative role, catastrophic role, into the delivery of aid. Paradoxically, you can decrease the possibility of development in a country if you pump money in this country and this money goes into the wrong hands. And I am convinced of that, first because I was the administrator of the UN program. So I saw concretely how aid is delivered and how aid can worsen a situation instead of improving it. And also because I saw the example of South of Italy, my own region, Calabria. Calabria was devastated by the fact that there was a huge increase of public money coming from the state and from the Union, the European Union, money that went into the wrong hands. Money that strengthened the mafia in Dragica was strengthened by this money because they monopolized this money. Monopolizing this money allowed them to have a negative effect on the rest of the economy. Allowed them to be stronger, to blackmail or to kill good businessmen, entrepreneurs who had been obliged to fly, to escape from Calabria, and this, in 20 years, created a disaster. So paradoxically, the more money you give to them, the more powerful they become, the more negative is the effect on the development of Calabria, and also partially in Sicily is a mechanism quite similar. Can you explain why Sicily, since 50 years, is enjoying a special status, is a regione a statuto speciale? They receive every year a huge amount of resources from central state and from Europe, and their real development, the rate of growth of Sicily is minimal. Minimal. The figures are huge, are enormous. It's around between 15 and 30%, according to the region, but Sicily and Calabria are quite similar, of the GDP of this region. And they don't grow. Other regions, paradoxically, who receive less money from the central state, but have a different structure, they grow, they grew. You take Abruzzo, or Sardinia, in the last 40, 50 years, they grew so much that they cannot be really considered anymore underdeveloped region, belonging to the south. They are now more or less belonging to the central Italy in terms of income, because they grew very much. Why? They get less money than Sicily. So this is the paradox. If you extend this paradox worldwide, you have basically the same picture. This is the reason why now international aid is changing. There are new parameters taking into account this fact. For instance, corruption. Until 5 or 10 years ago, in the World Bank, the word corruption was forbidden. You could not print in an official document of the World Bank the word corruption. The first president who broke this taboo was Wolfensohn, Jim Wolfensohn, the former president. He told me, when I pronounced the word corruption, saying that maybe some World Bank money was squandered with corruption in our projects, I was forbidden by the speechwriter and the others, this is not, and by the stakeholders of the bank, who say, we are not supposed to say that. Because this is politics, it's not World Bank word, it's not World Bank language, you cannot say it. And then he started a big fight for including the issue of corruption into the safeguards of the World Bank aid. This change of framework is helping very much, I believe. And this is a very positive development, securing now. Not only the issue of corruption is addressed in all the issue of international aid, but there are quite serious safeguards that are starting to be put in place to avoid the perverse effect I quoted you before.
That's Christina Cascuti from the Times of Malta. To go back to terrorism, so do you think Bin Laden is not the world's number one enemy? The world's number one enemy?
No, I believe he is not the world's number one enemy, absolutely. He's a terrorist. He's a terrorist who should have been captured a long time ago if the technique of fighting him would have been better. Not squandering billions of dollars in or invading countries for fighting terrorists who must be fought in a different way. I believe that anti-terrorism should be done with different instruments. First of all, the intelligence. Second, with targeted actions. Thirdly, mobilizing against terrorism. Good resources in civil society and in governments, and then we can overcome terrorism, like we did in Italy in the 70s. We successfully fought terrorism. That was a very serious issue. Terrorism in Italy in the 70s was a real threat to the country. We fought it without distorting the constitutional process, without putting in jail innocent people, respecting civil liberties of all people accused. But the reason why we succeeded to destroy terrorism in Italy was that we used an intelligent strategy. We mobilized the civil society. We isolated the terrorists from the workplaces and in society. And finally, we succeeded to destroy them. We never thought to send the army, fighting whom, why. We never thought to militarize the country for the fight against terrorism. And this was an example of a success. Other European countries did the same and succeed. The wrong way to fight terrorism is to play their game, to play in their hands. It means first of all, mounting a paranoia about terrorism, so making them very big, and making their acts much bigger than they are. If a terrorist act would be treated in the newspaper with a small title, just the information, without any hype, not going into paranoia and terrorizing people, terrorists, this would be the biggest blow against terrorism. Sometimes some government try to do it because all experts, we agree on this. If there is one thing that unifies all experts on terrorism worldwide is this, that the hype, the media hype should be eliminated. Why to do terrorism if the newspaper would not talk almost the following day about what you did? You killed, 5 people, or 10 people. So what? There was a news. There was a news like, a car accident. People are very sorry. And that is it. This would destroy the incentive to terrorists. Because their goal is to make fear into the people. If you amplify this fear, if you create all this, you do them the biggest favor that you can do. But it is difficult to apply it because of all the things I said before. But I hope that now, with the change into the American administration, the new president, who understands perfectly what I'm telling to you now, he understood it perfectly, and he is already moving into this direction, is not throwing the country into paranoia like the President Bush administration, is having a much more intelligent strategy in fighting terrorism. This will be a very effective strategy against terrorism.
Regarding the video we watched about Afghanistan, I read on an article that during the Taliban era, opium production in Afghanistan had dropped to almost nothing, and then after the U.S. invasion, it increased again 8 or 9 times the amount. Later in the video, you said that, or as you were speaking, you said that you managed to eradicate coca fields in Colombia by providing alternative crops. How come this system hasn't worked in Afghanistan? Because as far as I know, by what I've read, farmers are replenishing their fields with opium because it's more profitable than you know, edible crops.
Yes, in the year 2001, there was no production of opium in Afghanistan because of our action, because of our strategy. We succeeded to create an alliance against the production of opium by the Taliban, an alliance by the six countries that surround Afghanistan. These countries are the first victim of Afghan opium poppy production, because 50% of the opium produced in Afghanistan goes to the countries that surround Afghanistan. Pakistan and Iran first. Pakistan has an astonishing number of addicts. Pakistan has more addicts than all Western Europe, all countries in Western Europe put together. We're talking about millions of addicts. Iran has almost 1 million of addicts on the other side. And also other countries that are also friends of the Taliban, like Turkmenistan and others, agreed with us in pushing on the Taliban in curbing the production. Then I asked for sanctions against the Taliban that have been enacted twice by the Security Council. So, at a certain point in the year 2001, there was no production of opium in Afghanistan. They enforced the prohibition of cultivation that we asked them to do. They asked me to provide help for their farmers in case they would stop the production, and I guaranteed to them that the international community would help the farmers. So in the year 2001, they stopped production. But in the same year, October 2001, the Americans invaded Afghanistan. And when they invaded Afghanistan, there was no opium anymore. So instead of maintaining this situation, they basically did an agreement with the warlords in Afghanistan, asking the warlords to help them in so-called fight against terrorists, turning their head the other way around about opium production. This was the substantial reason, which is now coming to the surface. Now they're starting to say that, as the number of information and testimony and so on coming up continuously, but this was the reality. This kind of non-written agreement with the major Afghan warlords allowed these warlords to create the cartel of opium, which was not before. Before this cartel, there was a very fragmented situation. Organized crime in Afghanistan, who collected opium from the peasants, did the transformation into morphine, and then send it to Western Europe, basically, were very fragmented. There are many groups, many mafia, small mafia groups. And the price of opium was very low. It was around 30. When I worked there, it was not more than $30 a kilo. So to eliminate production, give the peasants an alternative and livelihood was not very difficult. It was something less than $100 million a year. When this cartel was established, they succeeded to make the price of opium jumping from $30 a kilo to $450, $500 one kilo. It means that in 2-3 years, the number of Afghans making a living from opium skyrocketed until the current 5-6 million people. Until now, that opium represents half of the Afghanistan GDP, making the issue of eliminating it much bigger. Still possible, because the total tag, price tag of eliminating opium today in Afghanistan is less than $1 billion. which is really not a big figure. The war in Afghanistan is costing $20 billion a year. In a country whose GDP is 10 billion, the war costs every year twice the Afghan GDP. It costed until now, in 9 years, almost $200 billion. So what I'm saying is that we could, with that figure, we could buy all the Afghans, Taliban, not Taliban, everybody, relocate them in another place of the world, and making them happy for all their life, and to eliminate opium would cost $1 billion. Even today, with a quite high, now price of opium decreased a bit because of overproduction. They produce so much opium that cannot be absorbed by the final users in Europe, that are constant. The number of addicts in Europe is not increasing anymore, it's decreasing. So there is a big overproduction. The food prices now decreased substantially. So would be not difficult to eliminate opium production, and this would be the most radical measure against both insurgency, terrorism, and the poverty in Afghanistan. And it would cost, as I said, less than one-tenth of the current war, that is just a big business only for drug traffickers and arms producers.
Good evening once again. My name is Clinton Spiteri. I'm an engineer here, and I very much liked your comments about peace is that intermediary time between wars. But also the famous Leo Tolstoy also mentioned that there cannot be peace without war. Actually, I also like your comment about the sort of sensationalism that the media and the press actually enjoy. Take, for instance, swine flu, the millennium bug, and climate change. Who knows? At the end of the day, I think they all create jobs, and that's what everybody wants. Everybody wants a job, especially in this time of global recession. I am fortunate as well. I'm a sustainability consultant, so I'm enjoying that perk. Funnily enough, today you mentioned peace. Barack Obama won the Nobel Prize for Peace, which is quite strange because he got nominated only 11 days into his actual being a president. At the same time, in London, a hacker who went into the Pentagon sort of files was extradited to the United States to face trial there because it wasn't sufficient for them to face trial in London. So obviously terrorism is still quite important nowadays, and it's perhaps not just a matter of the 40 virgins in heaven. But coming perhaps to a question is do you see the fact that statistics say that serious violence and wars are reducing, the fact that we're approaching more of an individualistic society? Because it seems to me that the time coincides with the promulgation and acceptance of internet on a more global level. So in a way, it's ironic how perhaps internet is a means of communication, yet that we have become more individualistic. Whereas on the very opposite side of the spectrum, perhaps poorer countries where internet is not yet so much available, I'm talking about Islamic countries, this seems to be the source of the evil and where wars are coming from. I just wanted your sort of comments about various threads and strands of this. Thank you.
You quoted a set of false or half or constructed facts that are very much in line with what I think. Swine flu, for instance, fit perfectly to my picture. is a big business based on zero risk and big business for producers of vaccines. Climate change, I'm not sure, is a hype. I mean, there can be a bit of exaggeration, but probably there is much more ground in being worried about it than the other so-called false threat. Internet can be an important antidote for the issue of the deception, because it can be a vehicle of different analysis, can be a vehicle of different informations, and so on. The big issue with the internet is the anarchy of this instrument of communication, the lack of filters, the lack of direction, and the fact that the internet can be the vehicle of unjustified fears and deception. But as a whole, I believe it can play quite a positive role. In my book, I quote several big deceptions of the last years. For instance, the three major wars we got: Afghanistan, first of all, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And I try to deconstruct the lies that have been spread all around about the motivation of these wars. And I say that myself, I was a victim of this deception. What struck me a lot was the Kosovo War, 1999. I was there at the time at the top of the United Nations in Vienna, so I had a privileged access to information that was occurring in the Balkans. And I initially supported the Kosovo War, because I still believe into the humanitarian intervention. I believe it is right for the international community to intervene, even in the use of force, when a genocide is occurring in any part of the world. Because it was the codardy of the international community who provoked the biggest genocide of our time, which was Rwanda in 1994. So I believe it was correct and right to intervene in Kosovo to impede the genocide that was occurring there, genocide of the Albanian population in Kosovo by the Serbs force. Then, step by step, I had offices on the field there. And in Vienna there was also the OCCED headquarters, Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe, who had observers on the ground in Kosovo and Serbia. And what these people were telling me, with reports, written oral, was that the situation was different. So there was no genocide occurring there. There was a civil war lasting since 10 years, with 2,000 people dead, but on both sides, but it was a civil war. Genocide is a completely different story. Genocide is the biggest crime. It needs a plan. It needs a structure for execution, which was not occurring in Kosovo. So the reason for a war there, for the use of force, that kind of use of force, with massive aerial bombing of Serbia, not of Kosovo. So, you know, it's like, I mean, civil war occurring in Sicily and international force bomb Rome. No? The massive aerial bombing with a lot of civilian victims and the destruction of the civil infrastructure of a country like Serbia was deeply wrong and unjust. So I changed my position because I had the privilege to get completely different information on the ground. People from OCCED, from the organization, who were on the ground, told me it is absolutely not necessary to have all this intervention. If you increase the number of people on the ground, increase the number of the forza di interposizione, interposition force, between the parts, if we say that there were 150 observers, if you increase us up to 500, 1,000 people, there is no need to fight with the airplanes. We can be the interposition force that avoid conflicts. So there was another solution. There was no necessity of war. But it was a big lie, and I was a victim of them, because I realized that if me, in my position, I was decided that way, you can imagine that normal population receiving false reports, false information, and false news. So my believing is that behind every war, there is a big lie. In Iraq, it was very clear. I mean, there was no reason whatsoever to leave Iraq and so on. So this is a very serious issue that affects very much our view of the world, affects foreign policy, and access to information is the crucial point. Thank you very much.